Okay, so just for fun, what's a modern Orthodox perspective? So we'll treat and we'll just quote the Rav. So if you look at the Rav, the next line, the Rav says, the description Kodesh Kodashim, which Mishnah Yadayim uses with regard to Shir Hashirim, refers to the divine symbolism described in it. However, this description also expresses a halachic principle. This Megillah may not be interpreted kipshuta. The entire Torah we can interpret either kimidrasham or kipshutam. Pshuto shel mikra is a chefza of Torah, an object of Torah. But with regard to Shir Hashirim, the literal meaning was excluded from the category Torah. That's a very strong line, right? So the Rav takes the claim that if you study Shir Hashirim and your goal is to understand literal meaning, you have not learned Torah. You cannot say a bracha on having learned Shir Hashirim with its literal meaning. There's no purpose at all. Now, this to me has a fundamental problem. Fundamental problem is that it assumes that you're experiencing Shir Hashirim in translation. But what if you just read Hebrew? If you just read Hebrew, you can't not think of the literal meaning. So that, right, to me is actually a fundamental problem with this claim. Right, the Rav saying that that there's no kiyum of Talmud Torah to lain Shir Hashirim, because the words are meaningless. Right, and that's a very, very strong and difficult claim to defend, but it's also useful as a contrast to David Zinberg and William Kohlbrenner's assumption that modern orthodoxy is about the literal meaning. Who gets to define modern orthodoxy? Yes, you do.
Uh-huh. I don't think that's difficult at all. I think that's what the Rav was referring to. The Rav is saying, if you read it and think about a woman, some man that you're in love with, that would be what you would object to. I do not think you would object to reading the Hebrew. I don't think your claim is true, that you can't read the Hebrew and do what he was saying.
You can read the Hebrew and... So the question is the Rav open to a notion of thinking on two levels simultaneously? Right? Is that is there a middle ground where you can where as opposed to going from one to the other, you are constantly thinking about what does this mean and what does this meaning mean?
He says the pshuto, the literal meaning is excluded from the category.
Yes,
that seems to be a little more than what Yehuda said, because it seems that if you understand the Hebrew, then you have immediately gone away from Torah. And it's only when you then say, oh, this must mean that other thing, you kind of approach Torah again, but you were away from Torah for that moment while you were...
So that could be. The challenging thing is, and this is all right, is that this work of Vikashta Misham begins with a magnificent riff on Shir Hashirim, in which he uses the same language to mean something else. So, hard, but he does say it. Right? It could be one of those moments when the Rav gets swept away by his own rhetoric. Which I think happens a lot more than people. Rav Lichtenstein says this, that there are times when the Rav just got swept away by his own rhetoric, and I think this may be one of those. It may be a little stronger. Yes, Yanni.
And also a little stronger than the way you described it, in the sense that, and then you said that by like a dichotomy, either you take the literal meaning, which may be more accurate, or the allegorical meaning of the drash, which also might be more accurate. The question, which of the two is more accurate? I want to get the accurate more than the other, or neither, or only one, you might be exclusive one not the other. But the Rav's description is much stronger than that. And then he seems to argue that it's not just that the literal meaning is inaccurate, but the literal meaning is a desecration of the sefer itself. And then it's problematic to talk about literal meaning, or even to think about literal meaning, because it desecrates the entire
view. So you can read the Rav as endorsing the code. Alright? It's a complete code.
No, it's a very strong version of the code, yeah.
Yeah. It's just challenging because the Rav wrote a sort of creative decoding of Shir Hashirim, which is difficult to imagine how he could.
I mean, he talked about a symbolic meaning, right? Which, sure, I guess symbol could mean code, right? But it sounds more like allegory than like code.
Yeah, it's hard because the whole Uvikashta Misham itself is a symbolic reading of Shir Hashirim, which rests on the power of the metaphor. Essentially, what you could argue is that the classical rabbinic reading was that the woman is the Jewish people, and the male is God, and the Rav rewrote it where it's about individual human beings and love of God. And that rewriting doesn't make any sense unless you have some, right, unless you're relating to it in some ways. It's very hard to believe he meant that, even though he does say it. Right? So I want to give you honestly, but I don't believe he meant it. But I agree that you could read it like Yoni, and you know, it sounds like he's saying it. That's why my most likely reading is he just got carried away. That really needs to be have to understand that that happens more often than people give think it does. Yes, Naomi.
Written in this particular way. And so it sounds like the Rav is saying, you know, it would be a desecration even to ask what is it about this book that needed to be written in terms of a love relationship?
That's right, because if it's a code, then the love relationship is irrelevant.
And I guess I'm saying, I think, I don't have the answer, but I think that's a very important question. If you're learning a book that is in fact a sacred text, part of the Bible, not to be able to try to figure out what is it that it's telling us in doing it this way?
So I agree, right? I think if you assume that you don't already know what it means, right? That is the.
But if it's, I think what she's saying more is that if it's really supposed to be just code, why bother using this beautiful language? It should have been written. You know, we're writing on the board on Wednesday. Like, you know, it didn't even have to be in understandable Hebrew words if the whole point of it was to be away from.
Seems like a pity, right? That's true. It seems like a pity.
Nice sentences.
Right, so it seems a pity, because it would be such a cool metaphor.
But I guess I don't see why you're reading the Rav as being about that, saying that it's a code and not an allegory. It seems that I just read what he was saying as, if I took, say, Mishlei and I published it as, here's a book of Proverbs, right, with no religious connection to it, that there still would be in those Proverbs themselves the, you know, a status of Torah. But that if I took Shir HaShirim and I divorced it completely from any idea that there was an allegory of relationship with God, and I just published it as a book of love poems, that there's that book of love poems doesn't, without reference to the allegory, doesn't have.
Okay, so you want to read it more narrowly than Yoni. I think that that he means that if you leave it there, right? Yoni wants to read it more radically as saying just even that thought process, the notion that I should interpret the poem as opposed to take out my code book and figure out what every fifth letter means, is a waste of my time. Right, I'm just being fooled by the plain text when really it's a cryptogram. Right, so that's a fundamental issue. So what I set out to do, right, I assume with all of you, right, I'm trying to be honest ideologically. But I assume with all of you that there has to be a reason. I think Naomi frames it well, right? There has to be a reason that it's written as a love poem.
I think the answer both to your question and the fact that the Chalidim are so averse to taking it strictly as an allegory, we just say they're interpreting what it means as if it means directly that way, is that when you take something allegorically, then the allegory goes both ways. In other words, and what many people have taken it is, that not only can you think of love in terms of love towards Hashem, but there is a divineness in physical love also.
Sure, all right, that's what William Kalbrenner argues also.
Now that kind of notion,
the Chalidim. So I have to say I disagree completely, right? So I think that the modern Orthodox claim here is completely, right, it's untrue. I think that the art school thing particularly is that people should not be able to do that if they don't have access to the Hebrew. But if they have access to the Hebrew, I don't think they have any difficulty at all. And I think that a part of the modern Orthodox issue is that we want to give people access to the text even if they don't know Hebrew.
Yeah, but what I'm referring to is the fact that it goes in the other direction.
I know, but I don't think Haredim object, except outside of Gur.
I find Rav Soloveitchik rather, at best, ambiguous as regards whether you can take it in that way.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay, good. But I'll tell you, so I put out the ideology, and I want to tell you what I tried to do. So here was, my question was, so I was reacting, the translation I was reacting to was the Block translation, which it seemed to me was designed to make the text as unsacred as possible. Right? The block translation, the goal of it on every page is to prevent you from reading, right, from moving to allegory and keep you locked into the physical human relationship. Now, you could then decide to allegorize it like you can allegorize any love poem. Right? That's often, you know, right? You can take any love song and you can say, oh, this is really about God. That's fine. But the goal of the translation is to never give you a moment where you question whether this is really about God. Right? No, it's about human beings. It's right. Everything is physicalized to the extent possible. The King James and the translations like it tend to leave it ambiguous. Right? You can read it as a love poem, but they don't do it in ways that make it hard to say this is an allegory. What I wanted to know was, is it possible to translate it in a way that is literal, but makes it, but compels you to think of it as an allegory? Right, that was right as a bridge between those positions. Right, I wanted what I called a literal religious translation. And so, first, I have to justify what justifies me in saying this. Other than, right, is it just a traditional claim, or is there something in the book itself which drives you to think of it, right, to say this is actually a religious book, and right, as opposed to, let's, you know, perfectly reasonable thing, this is a series of love poems that were so good that somebody said, well, since the best analog to love of God is love of human beings, so a really great illustration of love of human beings will be a really, really useful religious text. Right? Is there something about this book, right, that we say, you know, if you really get it right, you will understand that it's not just, here's a good description of human relationships and all descriptions of human relationships translate to God, but it's a description of a religious relationship which uses human relationships as a mode of helping you understand them. So here's my, I have one piece of evidence that to me militates in favor of the notion that the song itself tells you that this isn't, that that's the way you're supposed to read it. And the answer is, and that's in terms of oaths. So there are oaths that, the way I translate it is a Greek chorus. And the Greek chorus occasionally talks about an oath that the female character made them take. And I don't know how many of you ever take oaths, or listen, you know, but probably most of you, when you take oaths, don't swear by wild animals. By the deer. Right, by the deer and the rams of the field. So it happens that the characters in Sherishrim do swear by the deer and the rams of the field, and it just so happens that if you swear by deer, you end up swearing by Tzva'ut, and if you swear by rams, you end up swearing by Elim. Or I looked. So it seemed to me that was a clue. If the oaths are really religious, even though in the warp and woof of the song they're about animals, that's a clue that you should be reading God in lots of other places. So that was my justification. The first thing I said, well, here there's an easy way available in English that is not available in Hebrew, and that is you can capitalize pronouns. If you capitalize pronouns in English, that tells you whether you're dealing with God or human beings. Because if you capitalize the pronouns, that tells you you're talking about God. So all of a sudden, right, if I say in the first line, let him, capital H, kiss me. So now there's no way to avoid recognizing it's about God. So that was the first move in the translation, which I thought was a nice way of bridging the two challenges. Because I think that in the Hebrew, there's no way you can't go through the literal meaning. In the English, all the other translations force you to choose. And I said, well, here's a way where we can take advantage of something that exists in English and not in Hebrew that will let us experience it at both levels simultaneously. I'd be careful about translations. I know that one of my friends likes making fun of German philosophers who believe that you can solve most problems by capitalizing nouns. Right? This is not being, it's being. But German, right? There are no capitals in German, right? So it's not really, right? It's only a phenomenon of the translation. It's not a phenomenon of the, right, of German philosophers. But that was my first move, was to see what would, now, what that did was, as opposed to all their translations. So one of the mysteries of Shir HaShirim is you can never figure out, you often cannot figure out who's speaking. And so English translations leave the pronouns ambiguous. But if you have to choose, right, if you can't, right, whether to capitalize the pronoun or not, then you lose that option. So my translation, right, my translation is much, much, much clearer about who is speaking when. Than other translations. And to make that really clear, in the full translation, I actually put the characters in different fonts and colors. So right in the full color version, the female character speaks, like, stereotypical female character speaks in pink, I think, and the male character speaks in green, and the Greek chorus speaks in purple. Absolutely, absolutely.
Rachel, it's ambiguous. If in Hebrew it's ambiguous, who's speaking? Or it's not clear, and you make it clear.
That's right. So I made that choice
here.
So I did make that choice. Right? So that was a choice I made in this translation that I was going to take in order to make this meaningful. I actually had to decide. Right? I had to actually decide who was speaking when, even though in the vast majority, right, many, many cases, it's really not clear who is speaking. Now, at this point, you get into all sorts of much more controversial things. So let's just try and translate the second verse the way we had it, right? So, Yishakene minishikot pihu, ki tovim dodecha miayin. Right? So, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love. So we have a shift. In the very first sentence, right, we start off in third person. Right? Let him, third person, kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your. So how do you justify a translation from third person to second person? Yes, you do. So this is a little complicated, right? You know, where the author is, you know, becoming a 21st century, you know, American athlete, always talking about themselves in the third person. Where else do we have characters in Tanakh talking about themselves in the third person that way? And why would we suddenly be doing it? Now we have other examples. We have religious language, for example, brachot, right? Where we shift when we address God, we shift from second to third person. And if it's an allegory for God, then we understand why the king is why the king is a metaphor. So there are all sorts of choices that open up, right? All sorts of things change dramatically, right? If you make this choice. Now, on the other hand, there is no way to create a consistent narrative if you keep the gender straight, right? On rigid biblical Hebrew. Right, just try and follow, right? You can just try and follow. So let's, if you take verse 3, right? So it's Mashcheni, right? Draw me. Acharecha Narutza. So Acharecha Narutza is after you, male, male, female will run. Who's the, where does we come after anyway? And it's Mashcheni, singular, right? Draw me, singular. Acharecha Narutza, afterwards we will, right, afterwards we will run. So where did the we come from? Heviani Hamelech Chadarav, the king brought me into his rooms. Heviani Hamelech Chadarav, Nagila V'nismecha Bach. So Heviani Hamelech Chadarav, so clearly the king is masculine. Nagila, we will rejoice, V'nismecha Bach, now Bach is feminine. So I'm assuming that's a fair question, right? I'm assuming, right? You if you want to create a coherent narrative, you have to assume that the male is the king.
No. Third person.
So there's another character getting involved.
That's right, and actually fits that first part much.
Why are you in the middle of you're in the middle of talking to your boyfriend? You say, "Oh, by the way, yesterday the king brought me into his rooms."
Because the king keeps interrupting their relationship.
The king keeps interrupting their relationship. So Aviani HaMelech Chadarav is not joyous. Heviyane Melech Chadarav, it's uh-oh. Heviyane. Okay, right, these are all huge choices to make.
And why is the Shekhani pull me? Why draw me?
Good for what? Draw means pull.
Well, in that sense.
Yeah, you just have to be careful. Right, you have to be very careful. The King James does this all the time. Like there are all sorts of verses. I used to be, hopefully not as much anymore, astonished to find out we're in Tanakh. Because I had King James translations in my head. Like, for the meek shall inherit the earth. right, which is in Tehillim. But I just, right, but because the word meek nowadays means like this, right, but meek just meant humble as a translation of Al-Navim Yeshuaretz. But it's a, but it just never occurred to me because I had the word meek in a 20th century meaning in my head instead of in a 16th century meaning in my head. So we have Heviane Melech Hadarav, so that is presumably the female character talking about the king. Then Nagila Vanis Mechabah, we will rejoice in you, feminine. So if you want to disambiguate, and that's right, so you'll see. So one of the radical differences you'll see between my translation and all the others in the third sentence is that all the others read it as one character speaking all the way through, and I read it as a dialogue. Right. She says Mashcheni, he says Acharecha Narutza. She says Aviyane Melech Chadarav, he says Nagila Venis Mechabach. Right. He goes on to say Naskira the Decha Miyayin. And she says, "Me sharim ahivucha." So, right. So the whole nature of the verse, right, of the verses change because once you have to decide who's speaking, so the whole thing is transformed. So I wanted to, so that happens throughout the translation, right? That you have a reading, and this is what I want to argue ultimately is the way we should translate Shir Hashirim, is that we should translate it in a way where the metaphor matters, but the metaphor is never divorced from its religious implications. And that we should recognize that that changes the way in which we interpret the text, because there are certain kinds of things that make sense. Now, there are much bigger assumptions. So let's talk about, we have like 7 minutes left, I want to talk about some of the things that Rashi actually does. We'll turn to page one of the packet. So the page one I gave you in the Shir Hashirim Rabbah, a whole set of enormous claims in the Midrash. So the Midrash gives you, the Midrash tries to identify at what point in history Shir Hashirim says, and then it tells you that it, depending on what point in history it says, also depends who the speakers are. So there's a version of Chinan Bar Papa that it was said at the splitting of the Red Sea, and it was said by Bnei Yisrael. But according to Rabban Gamliel, Yishakeni Mishikot Pihu, is a plea by the angels who are jealous because Nishikot Pihu, of course, is when God told us, gave us the Ten Commandments, and the angels are jealous because they don't have Torah. And so all the Song of Songs is an allegory about the angels wishing they could have Torah the way human beings do. All right, which is our whole radical transformation. So there are all sorts of ways of, right? Obviously, Shir Hashirim is a radically different book if it's about angelic jealousy of human beings. And it's about human relationships. Now, if you turn to page four, I think it is, right? This is where we have what Rashi actually says Shir Hashirim. Rashi actually says Shir Hashirim means, and you'll see that what Rashi says. If you look at the bottom of the page, Rashi says, "So I say." Solomon saw via the Holy Spirit that Israel would in the future be exiled, exile after exile, and destruction after destruction, and that they would lament in this exile their original dignity and remember their initial affection, that they were his treasure from all the nations, saying, I will go and return to my first man, for it was better for me then than now. And they would remember his acts of loving kindness and the offenses they offended, and the good which he had said he would give them the end of days. So he found this book via the Holy Spirit in the language of a woman bound in living widowhood, yearning for her husband, leaning towards her intimate, reminding him of youthful love and conceding her guilt. And then her intimate remembers this also. So what's the amazing thing that Rashi does to the text? What does he put in that is nowhere there in the text?
It's about his modern history from his perspective.
That's true, but that's in the text. That's fine. What does he put in that's not in the text?
Exile was in the text.
That's just... I want to tell you what he, before you get to the to allegorizing, in the literal meaning, allegedly, what does Rashi put in the text that's not there? Yes, Harvey.
It means
that he's gone. That he's gone? What do you mean?
That the male character is reminiscing for someone who's not there anymore.
Aha, all right. So the opening story is longing, right, when he's not really present. So that's a really important interpretation. Good, but it's even more than that. Yes, Levi.
I was
husband, meaning?
Marriage.
Marriage. The relationship, right? Rashi says the interpretation is about somebody whose relationship has previously been consummated. Right? And the whole book is an attempt to right? It's not about young love. Right? It's not a romance between, between teenagers. Right? It's not even a tachlis date. Right? It's a woman who's been married, her husband left her, didn't give her a get. She's been in aguna for years. Right? It's sort of really pretty startling, right? Rashi says that that we the Jewish people have been in aguna for years. And this is a story about the attempt, the dream of reconciliation after years of being in aguna.
Well, he does say it was youthful love.
It was, right? We remember. Now, all of this, Rashi takes all of this from the opening chapters of Yirmiyahu. Right, the opening chapters of Yirmiyahu set up this image of Jews as, right, Jews and God as having had this romantic period in the desert. And then, we're horrible, and so God sends us away, but he never divorces us. Eza sefer kritut asher natati lachem, right? Where is the bill of divorce that I gave you? And so Rashi reads this straight as a, right, as filling out Yirmiyahu. I should point out, by the way, for the record, that this is consistent with Rashi's reading of Yirmiyahu, but now we talk about how text changed. So this is all based on, you probably all know from the song, right? Ko amar Hashem, zacharti lach chesed nu'rayich, avat kulutayich, lechtech acharei b'amidbar be'eretz lo zirua, which you all translate in your heads correctly as, right? Ko amar Hashem, so says God, zacharti lach chesed nu'rayich, I have recalled for your sake the chesed that you did when you were young, avat kulutayich, the love that you showed when you were a bride, when you went after me in the desert, be'eretz lo zerua, even though it was a trackless waste, and you might have expected to starve. For the record, Radak translates this that pasuk as follows: So says God, Kilmar Hashem, Zacharti lach chesed nirayach. I have reminded you over and over again of the great things I did for you when we were young. Avak lulatayach, how much I loved you when we were first married. Lechtech acharei b'midbar, when you were passing me in the desert. There is lo zerua, and I could have let you starve, but I didn't. So the whole metaphor that Rashi attributes to Shir HaShirim doesn't exist in Radak. Right, Radak thinks that that whole thing doesn't exist. But let's assume that Rashi is working correctly. So now I just want to, by contrast, the Rav Kedarka Bakodesh. So of those of you who have read sections of the Rav, so you know that or if you haven't, I will now introduce you to this notion, right? The Rav is all about dialectic. And one of the big things about dialectic of the Rav is that human beings are powerfully attracted to God. Right? But there's this incredible attraction. But the closer you get to God, the more you realize how God is so much greater than you. So just as you're being attracted as close to God as you can be, you get repelled. And so human beings never actually reach God. So religion is all about this oscillation where you're constantly being drawn to God, but you can never reach God all the way. And this is the Rav is following an academic position that was very popular during his career, which is that Jewish mysticism is different than Christian mysticism. Christian mysticism attempts to achieve what's called unio mystica, where the human being actually unites with the divine. But Jewish mysticism always maintains the selfhood of the mystic. That has since been called into question. That was Gershom Scholem's position, but it has since been challenged by Moshe Idel and his studies of Avraham Belafia. But that's the universe the Rav functions in, where the academic assumption is that this is true. So the Rav's interpretation of Shir HaShirim is all built on the assumption that the relationship is never and can never be consummated, which is about as distant from Rashi as you can imagine. Because Rashi is all about the recall of a relationship that has been consummated. So now, the problem is, so we can take the Rav, let's suppose that we take the Rav at Yoni's word, as to what he meant earlier. How am I supposed to decide whether Shir HaShirim means what Rashi said it meant, or what he said it meant? If the literal meaning is utterly useless, in terms of figuring out what the text meant, then what am I supposed to do with it? So I think it's an unsustainable position. If you have an absolute consensus about what the allegory is, then you can claim that the original meaning, that the literal meaning is useless. But once you have diversity about what it stands for, then the only way you can possibly evaluate it, the only way you can distinguish between true and false readings, is by seeing whether they are consistent with the metaphor. So I think that even if we were to accept this theoretical position, the only result of that would be that the text is useless and there was no point reading it at all because we can't know, because we've obviously lost the code. Not only that, I want to argue that actually Sariyafit is completely wrong. And I disagree with David Zinberg. I don't believe there ever was a position in Jewish history, certainly not a dominant position, that said that it was a code and not an allegory. And the reason for that is if you go back to the Midrashim that I cited on page 1, you'll see that every Midrash, right, offers a coherent, right, says, well, if I say this about the text is written by at this time, then I have to be consistent about other literary features of the text. Right, I have to have a theory of the text that accounts for features of the text. So I want to suggest. So we started off by saying that there is. David Zinberg argues that that the modern Orthodox way is to focus on the pshat and leave it at there. Sariyafit argues that, right, and he argues that that's Rashi, and Sariyafit argues that Rashi was revolutionary. I don't think Rashi was revolutionary. I don't think there's anything particular in modern Orthodoxy, but what I want to argue, in fact, is that there has been a consistent posture all the way through, which is that it is a metaphor, but that the metaphor is informed by the literal meaning, and it may be that not only that the metaphor that there are many possible metaphors, right? That the thing, right, that it's many possible analogs of the original text, and they can all be true. But that we should, right? But we should be reading it constantly, thinking about how we can, how we can use this text as a way of thinking about religion, and recognize that it's not that you can take the text on its own and say, oh, what would that mean if it were a metaphor for religion? That what the text means is going to be changed by your assumption that it's a religious text, right? And that's what my translation is trying to show. There are other things that are worthwhile thinking about in terms of what assumptions you make about the text. So this I didn't have a chance to do, but I'll just close up. The word, how do you translate Shir HaShirim? So you can translate it most ways, Song of Songs. The Song of Songs is hopelessly ambiguous. What does that mean? So it can mean, for example, which is what some Rishonim say, it's a song of multiple songs. And so each chapter should be interpreted independently. Malbim takes that position. Right, each chapter is independent, and there's no real connection between them. What holds the book together is that it's a cycle of 8 songs.
No, not 8, 5.
Oh, he says 5. You're right. He says 5. Thank you. But it's 8 chapters, right? He crosses them. Right? You can take that position. You can say it just means the best song. Right? It's like the mother of all battles or whatever. Right?
Kodesh
HaKodeshim. Right? The holiest of holies. Malchei Hamlachim. The king of kings. So my translation is the song of all songs. Right, we're just pardon?
You get both.
Yes. But I also, right, I also have an illustrated version. And the illustrated version is letter art, which is designed to, in which either the word Shirim is composed of 8 iterations of the word Shir, or the word, right, or you have a song of all songs, which, right, where there are 8 songs around it, and the attempt is to try and convey visually some notion of all of it, of it as a coherent whole, and that's what my translation tries to do. Right, my translation tries to assume that there is a coherent flow through the text, and that you actually have to read it as a unity. And not as and that also changes translation dramatically. Yes, Yuda.
Shouldn't you translate the most song-like song, same as Kodesh Kodeshim and Malchei Melachim, the most king-like king?
I don't know that. I thought Malchei Melachim is the king of all kings.
Why?
Why not? I don't know. Kodesh Kodeshim is hard to say, the holy of all holies, but I'm not sure what that would mean.
Be the most holy of them. And similarly, I'd say the most song-like song.
Okay, nice. I don't know. It doesn't convince me. I don't know what a song is like anyway. Right, aside from leaving the question of what a song is.
And if you
have is it a poem? Yes.
Okay,
so bottom line. Bottom line is what I hope you get out of it.
It doesn't necessarily mean song. It could mean poem.
It could mean a public recitation. Right? It could mean lots of things. But I stuck with song. That's still the King James, probably influencing everything there. What I want to emerge from is an appreciation that, especially in Shir HaShirim translations. And even right, and translations which purport to be literal are actually often very strong interpretations. I think that the kind of middle ground that Yehuda was arguing for can be attained, right, where you are simultaneously thinking about what the text would mean if you translated it literally, and what the text would mean if you understood it religiously, and that those are not independent actions, but that they're constantly interpenetrating because. What the text means literally is affected by your belief that it's religious, right? Just as it is the other way around. And I wanted to problematize the notion of what it means to have a specifically modern Orthodox approach to the exercise of translation. And I guess maybe if I were to try it, begin to put an ideological mode on it, I would say that I was not happy with the translation. I'm not happy, really, with a translation that assumes you'll never read the Hebrew, either way. I'm not happy with a translation that assumes that you'll never read the Hebrew so I can write this independently. And I'm not happy with a translation that assumes you'll never read the Hebrew so there's no point in trying to tell you, right, in trying to give you access to the Hebrew. Right? What I'm going for is a translation that is helpful in making you reread the Hebrew. So that's all, right, Now, at the same time, I think that if you want to, I think it matters. I think you're absolutely right. I think it matters that it be written well. So if you write a translation that's bad poetry will not get you anywhere. And a translation that's bad poetry is just a dictionary. And at the same time, I guess I would be unhappy if my own translation, after it achieves massive commercial success, etc., ends up being so successful that people start interpreting it on its own as opposed to seeing it as a window into the Hebrew. Like a really successful translation of Shir HaShirim should be constantly driving you to look up the Hebrew and say, "Wow, can it possibly really mean that? Is that right?" And we have the problem that because people read it in Shul and Yontos, so nobody can take notes on the side, right? But the best case scenario is that next Pesach, you all have my translation in front of you, and then after Pesach, you're all desperately running for your copies to write down their notes of all the mistakes you noticed. While somebody was reading it, and you will notice lots of mistakes in my translation because you'll notice, for example, lots of places where I completely ignore gender, grammatical gender, because I think grammatical gender cannot possibly exist coherently in Shir HaShirim, and that's a general shita. As I told the students, I love quoting. There was one medieval Rabbi Yosef ben Kaspi who believes that there is no masculine and feminine in biblical Hebrew, and that. There are too many exceptions, and so there are just words that are often masculine and words that are actually often Hebrew, but whatever we think in real life, the gender binary in biblical Hebrew is an illusion, and you shouldn't keep words and grammatical forms the same way. So my translation is based on that, and you can decide whether that's a sacrifice that's worth it or not. It is necessary, I think, in order to create a... I think otherwise you will end up with many, many sentences that are hopelessly incoherent. You can't tell who's speaking and to whom. So, okay. Thank you for listening. That was fun for me, at least. Hope it was for you, and I look forward at least next Pesach to all of you sending me many, many critiques.